The words we live by.
The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations make free time available to present the Eternal Light summer series, The Words We Live By, a transcribed program which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Today, we present another in this series of informal and unrehearsed discussions of selected passages from the Bible. And now, we take pleasure in introducing our moderator, Professor Judah Golden of the University of Iowa. Professor Golden.
Today, once again, we've gotten together for one of the informal sessions of The Words We Live By to discuss a biblical passage and to think about the basic question which is raised in that passage. In addition to the regular members of the panel, Dr. Saul Ginsberg of the Psychiatry Department at Columbia and Professor Abraham Halkin of City College, we have as our guest Dr. Alice V. Kelleher of the School of Education of New York University. The passage and the question, which we're to consider in a few moments, is taken from the sixth chapter of Deuteronomy. And I've asked Roger Tuttle, our announcer, to read several lines for us.
When thy son asketh thee in time to come, saying, What mean the testimonies and the statutes and the ordinances which the Lord our God hath commanded you? Then thou shalt say unto thy son, We were Pharaoh's bondmen in Egypt, and the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand. And the Lord commanded us to do all these statutes, to fear the Lord our God, for our good always, that he might preserve us alive as it is at this day. And it shall be righteousness unto us, if we observe to do all this commandment before the Lord our God, as he hath commanded us.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tuttle. Dr. Ginsberg.
I think this passage from Scripture, like so many other passages, has wonderful meaning and cogency for our understanding of family life.
Mr. Halkin.
I was very much struck by how naturally the Bible lets the son ask the question and has the father answer the son's question.
Miss Kelleher.
Yes, I agreed with that. The statutes and the testimonies and the ordinances seem to me to be the beginning of the child's first meaning of law and order, which he gets in his earliest infancy in relation to the family.
Yes, but I think that the most impressive thing that strikes one just as you begin this passage is really the whole spirit of the lawgiver here anticipating that the child will ask questions. He may find it quite strange to see what the parents are doing, and he's entitled to ask the questions. Dr. Ginsberg.
I think democracy used in this connection is perhaps a cliche word, but I am impressed by the democratic spirit in which the child is encouraged to ask, in which he gets not only a civil answer, but an answer which doesn't in any way condescend to him, and which the matters are explained to him in terms which it is expected he can understand.
Mr. Halkin.
It seems to me that it shows deep understanding of the human psychology. A time must come in the life of a person when the obedience which he yielded as a child will begin to seem meaningless to him, and he'll try and understand it and seek explanations of it.
Yes, and in his feeling of his right to raise questions, he is going to be far more willing to accept law and order in relation to family living because he's treated as a reasonable person. I can't help but believe that this is closely related to the way he grows and develops as a citizen, because he has the chance in his early years to know and to accept, because he has the right to question.
I think it goes even further than that, really. In general, we know, naturally, that children learn from their parents in the first instance. And that would go just as well for religious truths as it would for other truths. Now, here the child is having explained to him a profound truth about the history of his people, presumably by a parent to whom he is deeply attached and whom he loves, and hence the word of the Lord has the special meaning which comes to words which are given to us by our parents.
The whole approach, I think, again, where you turn to the child in a spirit of instruction rather than arbitrary command, is what seems to impress everybody here right around the table, and I think every time one reads the passage, that's the first thing that comes upon us.
And isn't that word love the basic thing? I keep going back to this early acceptance of regulations, of the mother who has to say, no, at this time you cannot do this. But the mother can say that with love.
Do you find the word in the passage, Miss Kelleher?
Well, I find in the passage the statutes and the ordinances and that in time you shall say this unto your son. And therefore, I would understand that a certain element of firmness, a certain element of saying to your son, this is what it shall be, must be there, but it can be said with love. That's the important thing.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I think that there might be an assumption of a certain love existing between the child and the parent at this particular point, because it interests me that the lawgiver here, when he says a time will come when much of what you do will seem strange to your children, and your child will ask you, why do you do this? He doesn't say to the father, send him off to the priest and let the priest instruct him. But on the contrary, he says, you tell the child yourself. There must be some kind of understanding already in existence between the father and child so that they can count on it.
It was really to that mode of instruction I alluded to before. The father is really, especially if he's a good, kind father, beloved father, the best instructor any child ever had. And if he can transmit the word of the Lord in an understandable way to the child, he puts down a very firm and good foundation for reasonable behavior in the child's future life.
Mr. Halkin.
I don't want to quarrel with either of you about the presumed love between father and child on which this question and answer are based. But I think we ought to stick a little bit closer to history. The reason he asks the father rather than going to the priest is that the father was the one who was expected to instruct him in ancient days. There were no priests instructing children then. And if the son had a question, he very naturally turned to his father.
Well, I merely meant to point out that the very naturalist happens to be a very happy circumstance because the father is psychologically the ideal instructor in general. Whether that was by design or accident, I don't know, but it turns out to be a very useful device.
Well, certainly Scripture says, thou shalt say unto thy son. Now, of course, that could be broadly interpreted, that the person, all people who deal with children, could consider them their sons. But certainly this implies a close relationship of parent and children. And I have heard Dr. Ginsburg, some psychiatrists say, that a child who is truly loved by a parent couldn't become a delinquent.
Well, I think that's asking a little too much even of love myself.
Or of delinquents.
Well, delinquents will manage all right, but love as a guiding principle is a very important one. And in general, I think the most essential thing for a child is to be loved. There's no question about that. But whether it would be fair to say that that itself would be a prevention of delinquency, I would be very hesitant. I don't think it is, actually.
Mr. Halkin.
As an ignorant layman, I would really like to hear an explanation of the relation between love and delinquency, or rather love and the absence of delinquency.
Well, certainly this question of respect for oneself enters here. Now, this passage is a beautiful one. The Lord showed signs and wonders and gave this land to us and so on. And certainly anyone who feels the self-respect and dignity that goes with having been given and granted what is in this passage, plus the fact that he has a person who believes in him and trusts him and deals with his questions with dignity and honesty, is a person, I think, who is well on his way to being a fine person and a dignified character, and is certainly not going to be a candidate for delinquency.
Dr. Ginsburg.
I think there's a corollary to that that's important. We know that love is a wonderful guiding principle and basis for human life. In contrast to it, we would have fear, the severe father, the authoritarian father, or the authoritarian lord, for that matter. May I ask, is it really an accurate translation of the original scripture, that word fear? Is it true that God is to be looked on as a person to be feared?
Mr. Halkin?
Well, the Hebrew verb used here is usually translated by the word fear, but it isn't fear in the sense of fright, but rather in the sense of reverence and awe. We are told to fear God, not because we always stand in danger of being hurt by him, but because he is the great Lord that he is, and we owe the reverence and the awe to him.
Which would bring it much closer to love, then, as a guiding principle, really, because love and awe stand somewhat akin.
Yes, well, love is mentioned very, very explicitly in the Bible as a sentiment we owe to God along with awe. And with fear.
I wouldn't like to attribute the scripture interest in child guidance principles. That would be saying a little too much. But I think we must acknowledge that the insight that makes love the guiding principle and not fear, not terror, is a wonderful basis for any child guidance understanding.
I think that we'll find throughout Scripture that there is an attitude towards instruction which is very revealing. You take that magnificent passage, which is incidentally related to the discussion of love. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy might, or one might even say with all thy being. That particular passage includes the words, thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children. Here again, in our particular paragraph, there is an expectation that things which we may take for granted, our children may find strange, and therefore they will ask. We mustn't rebuke them. We have to answer them. Look at a book like Proverbs. In a book like Proverbs, once again, you have the assumption all the time that there is a relationship which makes instruction possible. And in that respect, I think we can say, without exaggeration, that throughout the Scriptures you have a recognition of the great role teaching plays in the life of children, in the life of parents who have to act as the teachers. And Mr. Halkin is quite correct. In that historical setting, the father was the natural teacher. Nevertheless, it is interesting that they anticipate even in the future, when they're trying to foresee what will happen in the future, that they still expect the home surrounding to be that kind, the milieu where the instruction is to take place. Miss Kelleher.
And the word teach, of course, is the important one. Because in this very same passage we read, and the Lord commanded us to do all these statutes. Now, are we going to teach by doing or by telling? And when Dr. Ginsberg says that we can't bring the Scripture into modern child guidance, probably the Scripture interpreted is one of the most modern things we have to go by.
Oh, isn't imitation the first method the child learns by? Don't we therefore teach by doing before we teach by telling?
Well, I believe so.
Well, we learn by identification, of which doing is an important part, to be sure. What interests me in this connection is the sound understanding of the whole instructional approach. The child is taught, he gets an answer which, as I said, is within, hopefully within his encompass. He isn't commanded to do such and such. It is explained to him why we do such and such, which is a much firmer basis for really inculcating sound principles, which will carry on from generation to generation. Or fear is not a very useful device for trying to get children to understand or to carry out commandments in general. We know much more is accomplished by explanation, by understanding, and by love, to be sure.
Would you eliminate fear from that? I don't know that I followed you there, Dr. Ginsberg. I don't want to misunderstand you, and you correct me if I am. I think everybody here is in agreement that the whole attitude of Scripture, that the relationship toward the child must be one of respect, so that one answers his questions, one teaches him. Nevertheless, I would get the feeling that Scripture would not eliminate the element of authority in the parent's relationship to the child. Scripture wouldn't speak only in terms of love towards the child.
Well, I'm not at all sure that authority requires fear as an element. To be sure, it often has fear as an element, but I'm not certain that's necessary. I think authority can be based on respect, on mutual understanding, and on love, without very much of any of the element of fear. Perhaps Miss Kelleher, who's had large experience, would say something about that.
Oh, I believe definitely that one can be firm without frightening children. Firmness is a very different quality from fright. And that's why I was so interested in your definition earlier of fear. That we're not talking about fear here. We're talking about the character of an adult upon whom a child can depend and on whose word he can depend. And I don't think dependability goes with fear at all.
Mr. Halkin.
And yet I must say that apparently love, like so many other terms in this world, can stand a good many definitions. I am thinking of a verse in the book of Proverbs which tells us that he who withholds his rod hates his child, so that apparently applying the rod is another sign of love.
But I would define rod, you see, as something firm and not something with which to beat.
Firmness is really sure.
Wonderful rod, that.
Well, without trying to decide what kind of rod, we know that children need firmness. A child who was thrown into an entirely free environment, if that were possible, would be terrified. A child needs the guidance of a strong hand. But I don't think we can emphasize too strongly that that is not the same by any means as saying that the child needs to be inculcated through the instrument of fear.
Dr. Ginsburg, am I perchance venturing into a field I have no right to by suggesting that you're really talking about a sense of security in the child which grows out of love and may not grow out of fear?
Yes, it grows out of love, but it requires as a guiding principle firmness. We know, for instance, that old question which is no longer so taken so seriously about when a child should be disciplined or spanked. The reason a child needs to be disciplined occasionally is not so that he will be frightened, but just because he needs firmness, he needs discipline to give him control over his own impulses. Otherwise, they simply run away with him.
Mr. Halkin.
But who'll decide what the child's reaction to the discipline will be, whether it'll be fear or whether he'll understand that it wasn't meant to frighten him, but rather to teach him?
Well, that's not as bad as you think. Actually, if the discipline is given by a parent who is loved and who is reasonably fair, and where the reason for the discipline is explained to the child, no harm will come of the discipline at all.
Miss Kelleher.
Well, you see, another beautiful part of this passage is this expression, to give us this land. Now, you cannot give to a generation that is not capable of standing on its own feet a land or the problems or the future which is implied in give us this land if those children have been so crushed and beaten that they cannot take it. They have come into a great inheritance. They have taken over an earth which was already there when they came in. Now, the question is, what qualities must the parents preserve in those children so that genuinely they can take over that land?
Well, I would say that the first quality would be maturity.
Because part?
On the part of growing maturity on the part of the children. Otherwise, they'll never handle their inheritance properly. Because they'll never have a sense of responsibility that's equal to the job that's imposed on them by this wonderful inheritance into which they come.
I'm wondering if Moses had half of these ideas running through his mind in the generation of the wilderness, or if a contemporary of Moses or a contemporary of the generation of the wilderness had some of these problems running through their minds.
They certainly had problems of discipline, of maintaining order.
Oh, the problems I'm sure they've had. I'm sure that they had trouble with their children even as we have trouble with them, and I'm sure the intelligent parents in the wilderness knew how to bring up their children just as intelligent parents today do. Dr. Halkin.
I don't think it ought to worry you, Mr. Golden, because 3,000 years of readers and interpreters have done exactly the same thing to the Bible that we're doing, and I see no reason why we should hesitate to read the Bible in the light of our day, just as they always did in the light of their own day.
I think Mr. Golden is disturbed, as frankly I am on occasion, when we use modern scientific terminology and apply it to Scripture. I can see where that does some disarray to his orderly understanding of Scripture. But I think we're simply translating into more modern terms ancient truths. I wouldn't think that Moses would have recognized a lot of Freudian terms. But whoever was the author of these passages certainly had the necessary insight and understanding of what was truly involved.
Ms. Kelleher.
I'd like to ask Mr. Halkin to give me some more help on interpreting to give us this land. What would you think the word give means there?
Well, in the light of the few remarks you made before, I think I'd rather not help you interpret it, because if we stick to what the Bible means, it simply means that they get the land of Canaan towards which they were moving as this was being told them. But I frankly liked very much the thought you were reading into the passage, give us this land, extending it far beyond the literal meaning. And I'd rather hear you elaborate on it, because I enjoyed listening to you.
Well, thank you. But to me, the word give is one that has to be interpreted, too, because one cannot take if he is not ready. And therefore, giving, as Gibran has said in the prophet, is something in which each of us is indeed a witness and not a giver. And therefore, it seems to me that we have to go back and ask ourselves about this whole development of responsibility. And the feeling on the part of so many people in this modern world, not only children, but grown-ups, that they indeed have been given something that is theirs, and that the moral responsibility for what they do with it, I'm thinking of this current world in which we're living, is something that has not taken on the depth and the dimensions that will make it possible for us to secure the peace.
If I may interrupt you, does the present mood come because people feel that they've been given? Doesn't it rather come because they feel that they've gotten? Because they forget that the things have been given to them, and they think that they've come into them by conquest, by earning, by some such process?
Well, I don't think it's only that we get. I think we must remember that when we are commanded to obey the Lord and to do righteous and the other things which are given us, we take on a terrific responsibility as well. I don't think it's only that we've come into evil ways because we have taken advantage of our inheritance. I think that the responsibility of the inheritance, of being responsible people for making the best use of the good that is given us, is a pretty difficult and onerous job. It's oppressive for most people.
Even being difficult and onerous, we must face it, and somehow or other we must tackle it. Now, I think of this. I see many children who, through inheritance of another sort, have been given good brains. Now, are they being reared in such a way that they recognize that that gives them extra responsibility?
Yeah, there may be an answer, Miss Kelleher, in the very answer which we find in Scripture itself in this particular passage. If you don't mind, I'd like to get off the question when your child asks you what do all these statutes mean, and see the answer which is provided here in the text. The text says what? When the child has asked the question, then you reply as follows: we were Pharaoh's bondmen in Egypt. Put very simply, once upon a time, my child, we were all slaves. And the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand. The freedom which you're enjoying, my child, the father says, is a freedom which you were not born with, or rather, we all were not born with. We just received. I would like for you to remember that there was a time when we were slaves. And therefore, if you enjoy the freedom, that freedom was an achieved thing, an accomplished thing. He certainly, the father, that is, certainly impresses the child with a sense of responsibility. And he does something even more than that sense of responsibility. I must confess that I'm prejudiced in favor of the answer. I'm rather touched by the humility. Imagine a father saying to a child who's asked him about the origins of certain things, saying to this child, "Do you know, my child, once upon a time we were not princes, we were not kings, we were not the wealthiest people in the world, we weren't aristocrats. Do you know what we were? We were just a bunch of slaves." Mr. Halkin.
This is truly a sentiment that ought to be noticed and even emphasized. At the same time, however, I think we ought to go on to the conclusion of this recollection of history. The fact that what the father really wants to teach the child is the obligation to God. It was a favor bestowed on us by God. He drew us out from the land of bondage. Consequently, we owe it to him to obey his laws and his commandments.
The obligation to God would also include one's obligation to do right by one's fellow man and so forth.
Well, definitely, that's what the statutes are. But these statutes were ordained by God. And by behaving properly with our fellow man, we obey God.
So that both the humility to which Mr. Golden referred and this aspect of the beneficence of God are both excellent, also excellent child guidance principles.
Well, I think they're organically related, really. Imagine saying to a child, really, let's try to look at this passage with our normal imagination at work. If our children came to us and asked us, why do you do the things that you do? And we sat down and said to them, well, God gave these commandments. I don't know that that would make very much sense. But if we said to our children, do you know why we have to do these things? Once upon a time we were slaves. And we proceed to give them a history. You're telling them a story. And that impresses the child, I think, with a humility where the big word humility would mean almost nothing to them. I don't know what your experiences are with children, but I know if I tried to say to my child, My darling, you have a sense of responsibility. I'm not so sure that I would be greeted with the kind of reaction that I would like to get. But if, instead of using the word responsibility or saying we were commanded with the law, I gave him a story and told him what were the circumstances that led to that, I think we might get a response of responsibility or a recognition of the importance of the law.
I don't think the word matters. I think it's the kind of parent who does the instruction that matters.
Isn't there a slight difference between a father who comes and tells his son that the people he belonged to were once in bondage and one who would come and say that he himself was once in bondage?
Ah, but I think that's wherein, for example, the Haggadah, the prayer book that we use on Passover evening, is so especially perceptive when it makes the remark, in every generation, a man must look upon himself as though he were himself redeemed from bondage.
Well, we all have been in bondage in some measure. Every person has to grow out of some kind of emotional, moral enslavement. And if you teach your children that and teach them humility as against arrogance, you will have done them an immense good service. There's no question about that. Many children are brought up with an arrogant attitude towards themselves and the world in which they live in, and when they come to the inevitable grief of life, they're absolutely unable to cope with it.
And that's why I wanted more interpretation of this word give, because I believe you cannot give to someone who cannot receive, and that a person has to grow into his capacity to receive something as tremendous as in this, to give us the land.
But we have to teach him how to receive as well as give him.
Exactly.
Well, that is, I suppose, the principal lesson when the child asks the question, why has God commanded us to do these things? Or rather, what are these practices in which you're engaging? You tell him, once upon a time, my child, we were all slaves in Egypt, which is another way of saying not only your grandfather or your great-grandfather, but in that bondage you yourself participated, because if your grandfather had not been emancipated, you yourself would have been born a slave. And once the child recognizes the deliverance which his ancestors and himself went through, I think he is ready to approach the commandments which were given with a spirit of responsibility, and perhaps grow into the role which his father had given to him.
You have just heard another program in the Eternal Light Summer Series, The Words We Live By. Our moderator was Professor Judah Golden, and our panelists were Dr. Saul Ginsberg and Professor Abraham Halkin. Our special guest today was Dr. Alice V. Kelleher, member of the Department of Education of New York University. Be with us again next week when we will discuss the important issue raised by the third chapter of Deuteronomy, Behold with thine eyes, for thou shalt not go over this Jordan. Comments from listeners will be appreciated. Our guest next week will be Dr. Channing Tobias, Executive Director of the Phelps Stokes Fund. Free time to present The Words We Live By is made available by the National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations. This weekly transcribed program is presented under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America.